Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. And become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to the first episode of this new season, Season 9 to be exact. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of author Kyle Harrison, about horrific hazings, deadly decisions, flights of fancy, fanciful frights, Icarus Islanders. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Something is afoot at a college in the Northwest. Sure, college fraternities have a strange initiation or two, but one in particular is drawing notice for its peculiarities. In our first tale from Kyle Harrison, we're going to learn that some secrets are best left under wraps, or underground, as the case may be. Without further ado, I present to you, Beneath the Earth, Nightmares Dwell. Beneath the Earth, Nightmares Dwell, by Kyle Harrison, performed by Otis Gyre. I knew my time at Rossetti University was going to be something special, the minute I learned of its intriguing history. Originally used as a battle fortress during the last years of a strange land war amid pioneers of the Northwest, the last remaining soldiers actually died as a result of a massive flood from the nearby river. Some say that it was a demon from a nearby mysterious church that caused the river to rise. Others just chalk it up to Mother Nature. That same river was where I met the current headmaster, Albert Schmidt, who explained to me that entry as a student for the college required more than simply good grades. The deformities have special rules for their initiation ceremonies. It's meant to be a test of mental strength, to show how clever you are. To be honest, they demand perfection from their initiates, and we allow it because we believe it could better our entire staff. Or at least we used to. It's the type of stuff, I guess, that frat houses care about. We've allowed the tradition for as long as I can remember, but I must admit some of the activities aren't particularly safe, he said. But you don't have any proof to charge the different frat house leaders with misconduct. Albert gave a soft smile and commented, I knew your father, Robert, so I recognize how much getting into the school means to you. You're a bright young man with a good head on your shoulders and a goal for the future, which is why I'm telling you what you'll need to do in order to ensure that you remain a student here at Rossetti. You want me to spy on the frat houses? In a way, I have recently received reports from the Miska dormitory that their hazing rituals have caused 2 initiates to be injured and 3 to leave the school entirely. These sorts of numbers are not what we need to get funding. Truth be told, rumors like that could shut us down. But sadly, no one has come forward to the campus board or me so that we can rectify Miska is doing anything wrong. That's where you come in, my boy, he commented. It sounds risky. What reassurances do I have that if I do this, I'll be given a proper education? If I'm found out, none of the dorms will want me, I pointed out. I don't believe in favors, Robert, but these are unique circumstances. If you can handle the task I've given you, I will make sure that you not only get the best education possible, but your future here at the university is secured as part of the staff and potential future board, Schmidt stated. I could tell that he was serious. I had no idea how precipitous the dangers these frats were causing was, but from the way the headmaster spoke, I could tell he meant that the future of the entire college was at stake. Of course, I accepted the offer, not fully understanding the dangers ahead. He gave me the information of the presidents of the frat house at Miska. Their dorms sat directly on the west side of the river, perhaps a good 20-minute walk from the main campus, meaning that they could easily do whatever they wanted here away from prying eyes. The building looked old, probably originally meant to be a watchtower of sorts, to alert the rest of the fortress of incoming threats. It seemed symbolic of the way that Schmidt said they always were somehow aware of what the entire college was doing and had a leg up against competing frats. Other rumors swirled too. Some claimed that 10 members of the frat swore allegiance to dark gods in order to excel, naming the president as their leader even unto death. It sounded very cultish and a bit silly, but I soon learned as I was taken in for an interview process that some in the frat house took it very seriously. Robert Ward, your family is from North Haven, yes? The secretary asked as he took my information and checked all my paperwork. Schmidt had made sure that my application was appealing to the frat house. According to him, the type of student they wanted didn't necessarily have to be the top achievers. They're searching for a different type of metal, he explained. When the secretary mentioned my family history, I immediately felt offset by the inquiry. Yes, that's right. But how did you know that, I asked. North Haven has been a long-standing supporter of our local chapter, Jeremiah, who I'm believing was your cousin, graduated with flying colors just last year, they responded. Yes, we hadn't heard from him since then, so we naturally assumed he got a job somewhere on the East Coast, I said. Well, enough chit-chat. I take it that you want to see if you can survive the maze, he commented. My throat ran dry. I knew little to nothing about the challenge ahead, except that, apparently, it was dangerous. I wasn't even doing this for the reasons they thought, meaning the chances of my survival here were probably less likely than a willing participant. Is something the matter? The secretary asked. Then I heard the shuffling of feet from the back of the room and saw an imposing 6-foot-6-inch tall man come into the office. Did I hear that we will have a ward participating in the maze this time? The man asked, running his fingers through his beard. I smiled cordially toward him, the man's eyes shining as he extended his hand in a greeting toward me. Mitchell Whitecliff, president of the Miskit chapter of Rossetti University. I truly hope you're just as amazing as the other wards that were students in our halls, he commented. I really had no idea my family was even connected to this college. I never heard anyone speak about it, I admitted. Whitecliff gave me a knowing smile. Once you endure the maze, you won't either. I wasn't given any more details other than to arrive at the frat house around 7:13 that evening and bring with me only the bare essentials. I took that to mean food and water and maybe a few simple aid supplies, but when I arrived for the event, Mitchell took one look at what I had brought and snatched it from my hand. All of this stuff would give you an unfair advantage down below, he explained as he slapped an old campus map onto the table in front of me and three other initiates. I wondered if Schmidt had offered them the same deal or if they were here for ulterior motives. Unfortunately, with Whitecliff breathing over us, it was impossible to even learn their names. Do you know how it was that this fortress fell during the pioneer days? The watchtower thought that all of the armies would be coming in by land and had excellent views in all directions from above. But from below, they were very vulnerable, Whitecliff said. I tried my best to memorize the labyrinth underground tunnels, amazed by how expansive they were. These go across the entire campus, I commented. Once the base fell, the new owners decided to make sure that the strategy wouldn't work again, so they dug as many tunnels as they could. There was no rhyme or reason for any of them. In short, it was a maze fit for a minotaur, and even some of the workers wound up so disoriented and confused that they didn't know how to leave. They died down there, Mitch said as he offered the map to us. This is the only tool you'll need tonight. Not that it will do you much good. There are at least 5 different versions of this map that were sketched out, and no one can agree on which is the accurate one. The rules are quite simple. For the event tonight, you'll all be blindfolded and led to the depths of the tunnels. First one to escape before sunrise will be given a membership here at Miska, Whitecliff told us. 12 different questions buzzed through my head as one of his charter members put bags over our heads and commented, I will have you all grab a hold of this rope, and I'll tug you along in the direction you need to go. When you feel the rope has fallen, you may remove the bag from your head. If at any time you do this beforehand, you'll be immediately disqualified. Any questions? The other frat member asked. None of us spoke a word, and then we descended into the darkness. It was disorienting, being led into the depths of the earth with nothing to guide me, except the sound of footsteps and the gentle tug of a rope. The trip was quiet and foreboding. The air stiff and full of strange smells that I didn't even want to imagine what they belonged to. It took us about 15 minutes or so before the rope finally dropped, and the man announced, "You stand here for 5 minutes. Do not attempt to follow me." I listened until the sound of the footsteps was gone, and finally took off the plastic bag to get a good look around. It didn't help much. The tunnels were dark and lined with limestone and brick, with hardly any distinguishing features except the occasional graffiti and spider webs. This should be a piece of cake. I memorized the turns on the way down here, the guy next to me said, and he ran off through the left tunnel. I studied the different paths, debating which way to go. If you want to, we can travel together for a while. If we get out together, they have to let us both in, right? I told the other initiate. Sure. I'm John, by the way, he said as we started down the tunnel straight ahead of us in front of us. Robert, I replied. There were signs of crumbling brick everywhere, the decay of generations. It made me claustrophobic. And then we turned the corner. A skeleton. At first I jumped, and then I tried to calm myself and talk through this. They must be trying to scare us and confuse us, I told John. But he looked like he'd seen a ghost. A buddy of mine got lost in these catacombs about a year ago. Somehow he managed to keep his smartphone on him, and he thought that would help navigate the tomb. But instead, he used it to document what he found. This body is likely the first of many, John explained as we started down some stairs. The next level of tunnels reminded me of a subway station, with tile on the floor and a wide-open dark tunnel with rails on it. What could they possibly be moving down here? John asked. Again, I talked aloud to reassure myself all was as it should be. They probably haven't used this in years. It's abandoned like the rest of this place, I said, climbing down onto the rails. To prove my point, a few more minutes into the tunnel, we hit water and realized we couldn't go any further unless we swam. This way must be blocked, I told him. Did you hear anything? John whispered as we stood there. I could only hear the echo of our voice at first. Then it dawned on me. Low hissing noises from the walls. I didn't want to alarm John, so I recommended we turn around immediately. But it seemed like as we returned to the station, the hissing noise was persistent. In the dim light from God knows where, I soon discovered why. There were at least three scorpions on my friend's back, all of them with their stingers raised and ready to strike. John, do not move, I warned him. I had nothing to offer to swat the predator away, but slowly reached down to take off my shoe. As soon as he saw the small arachnids, he froze and began to hyperventilate. Jesus Christ, I knew this was a bad idea, he said. Just don't panic, I advised. The tiny creatures started to skitter toward his exposed skin. Easy for you to say. And then, from somewhere else in the tunnels, we heard a scream. John leaped and ran, and I tried to call out to him, but it was too late. He was gone. I tried following his trail, figuring that he'd get disoriented on his own quickly, but soon found I was traversing the tunnels for another hour in complete silence. The darkness was overwhelming. It was beginning to take its toll on my mind. I would sometimes hear the scorpions again and freeze, imagining they were now on my body. Other times, it felt like the walls were closing in. Nothing in the tunnels seemed familiar anymore. After further wandering, I found a long flight of stairs that led upward and figured it was my best chance to get back to the surface. Felt like it was leading directly out of the maze, but soon I found myself standing in what looked like a war bunker of some kind. There was exercise equipment stacked in the different corners that hadn't been used in ages, along with a dried-up swimming pool, and even had an old kayak as though preparing for the Olympics. As I explored the area further, I found athletes' lockers and uniforms, all of which looked as though they'd been rifled through. Then I heard a noise. "Don't make any sudden moves," I shouted. I didn't want them to be aware I had nothing to defend myself with. Then, from the shadows, I saw the other initiate stumbling and looking like he had just seen his worst nightmare. "You need to leave this place before they keep you here forever," he said, grabbing me and shoving me against the locker. What are you talking about? I asked. I've seen what they do to us, to the ones that survive. This is no contest. It's a trap. It's a mind game. You're delirious. Stay with me, I said, as I helped him out toward the equipment. He slapped my hands away and snapped, Don't you get it? This is all a ruse. We were led here to be experimented on. Then he ran off to the same flight of stairs I'd just climbed. I looked toward the other end of the athletic center and saw another flight of stairs to what looked like a fire exit. My curiosity to his strange behavior got the better of me, and I decided to investigate. Something about this had felt wrong from the beginning, and as I descended again into another murky part of the catacombs, I felt as though this time I was going to the depths of hell itself. The farther I went, the stranger the environment felt. There were rock formations and strange carvings in the walls, almost as though meant for some ritualistic purpose. And then, just as darkness completely overtook me, I hit a wall. I felt around the edge of the wall trying to get a sense of this, if it was really a dead end. It didn't make sense to me that the other initiate would be so upset about something so normal. Then I felt a handle and I pulled. A soft whirring noise filled the air, and the entire hall behind the door I was in front of became illuminated. I stepped into what looked like a secret laboratory. There were security monitors, medicine cabinets, and countless rows of data storage. Supercomputers, all watching every aspect of the campus above. As I explored, I soon realized that not only was this strange, secretive place still in constant use, but the things they were keeping an eye on were actually people. Students on the grounds above, each monitor labeled with numbers and symbols. What were they doing here? I moved toward the rear of the room, listening to the continuous hissing noises, the memories of the scorpions flashing in my mind. Then I saw something far more nightmarish than any insect could be. There were cryotanks, the kind that you only see in strange B-movies, and each one of them appeared to be growing what looked like a human husk. Most of them were unfinished, slowly metamorphosing before my eyes as my jaw dropped, and I felt a chill run down my spine. This was worse than the headmaster realized, but still I needed to know why they were doing this. I sat down at one of the terminals and tried to log in. Unsurprisingly, the network was completely secure. Then I heard a strange groan from somewhere above me. It sounded like someone in pain. I found the stairs and climbed up, wondering if maybe some of the finished specimens were kept here. Instead, as I approached the front door, I found the guide that had led us here, heaving and trying to stand. He'd been injured, attacked by someone or something. When he saw me, his eyes flashed in paranoia. Get away! Don't get near me, do you hear me? He snapped. What is this place? What have you done? I whispered. You wouldn't even understand. You have no idea how involved you already are in this place, he spat back. Tell me now or I'll leave you here to die, I snapped back. He laughed in a mad way, as though he wasn't even worried about that. Don't you understand it? This place was designed for perfection. We find the students that can become the next generation of that perfection. We choose them from all sorts of different places. You aren't special, Robert. You aren't even a candidate for this college, the man said. I think I was about to give him a smart comeback when I heard this low guttural noise from the other side of the chamber. I turned and saw it. It was this strange-looking half-human creature lumbering toward me, covered in blood. It had clearly not developed properly, or had been released too soon, and was now struggling to survive. As it got closer, I screamed and realized that it had my eyes, my face. This was a replica of me. I stumbled to where the guide was hunched over and shouted, "Do something before it kills the both of us." He laughed again and shouted, I told you it made no difference. You were brought here for a reason, Robert. Same as others before you. Perfection must be obtained. I ran, pushing past him to find another way out. The creature lurched and attacked him, its jaw opening wide to snap at the arms of the man as I found a ladder and started to climb. I could hardly breathe, hardly think, as I found my way up to the next level. Now I understood my colleague's fears. They were making monsters down here. Soon I found myself in a darkened elevator and started to climb up a rope. It was barely hanging on, but it would get the trick done. I could see sunlight and it spurred me onward. Down below I could hear the creature. It smelled fear, maybe even could trace the scent. The rope buckled, and I dared not look down. The creature was climbing after me. I kept scrambling up, my palms sweaty. I was going to make it. And then the rope broke, and I fell toward darkness into a void I couldn't escape. I blacked out. When I came to, I was under the lights in what looked like a college clinic. Headmaster Schmidt was there, along with an older lady I guessed was the campus nurse. "What? Where am I?" I asked, looking around. It felt like I was above ground, but I couldn't see outside, and for a moment I panicked. "Luke, one of the other initiates found you passed out in the tunnels. I'm guessing you were either dehydrated or starving. You were lost for 3 days," the nurse explained. 3 days? That doesn't sound right," I said. I felt hurt, like I really had fallen from a great height. All the memory of what happened rushed back, and I grabbed the headmaster's wrist. "I need to speak with you privately," I told him. He nodded and dismissed the nurse, his brow furrowing. "Sir, you need to be aware of what is happening down there. What Mitchell and his frat house and others, maybe, on the campus are up to," I said. "There's so much that I can't even properly explain, but I'll do my best." He listened as I gave him the story of a lifetime. He paused and asked a few questions here and there, but other than that, made no interruptions. "And you're sure this is what you saw?" he asked me. He showed genuine concern, not only for my well-being, but the others that night that might be lost forever. "Yes, sir. I would stake my entire life on it," I said. He sighed and looked down at his feet. "I was afraid of this. What's the school coming to?" He turned to call the nurse back in, but instead, Whitecliffe appeared from a doorway. "Wait, what is he doing here?" My mouth felt dry as the two men shared an unspoken look. "Robert, you are far more like your cousin than you may realize. Both of you have been failures in our experiments. We are striving to create perfection here. And to do that, you must endure this trial until you are the perfect candidate for our school. We need the funds, you see, and to do that, we're going to create perfect students," the headmaster said. "This was a test. You've been doing this to students for years. You've been creating and crafting them in those underground lairs as your puppets," I realized. The thought of the hundreds, or possibly thousands, having endured so much torture cast aside when these instructors decided they didn't meet protocols. "Nurse, can you get Robert a sedative?" Whitecliffe asked as I felt a cold chill fill the room. "We need him healthy for the next exam." I knew they meant to take my life and then recycle my body for another horrible experiment. When the nurse came in, I screamed and thrashed, hoping maybe she wasn't a part of this horrendous situation. She gave me a sad smile as she injected me, and the world went black. I'm alone now, trapped here, waiting to be put back in that maze. I keep thinking about the lives I've led, dreaming of the tunnels and the rats that are down there. Rats like me that I will transform into until I can outsmart the scientists. I can hear the walls closing in already, and I think I don't want to go back there. I can't. I have very little left I can do except perhaps to warn others. For some reason, I've been allowed the opportunity to move about my room. Perhaps they think I'm no longer a threat. I'm not sure. I've found a way to access the Wi-Fi for the campus. Whitecliffe hasn't come to confiscate my phone yet. Maybe they believe it'll make no difference, and maybe it won't in the end. But the only way this madness can stop is to get word out to others if I can. Warn them of what this place is doing under our noses. Don't come here. Perfection is not worth it.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
I hope you enjoyed Beneath the Earth, Nightmares Dwell, by author Kyle Harrison, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that first tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Harrison. No stranger to this podcast, you'll be directed to his author's profile on creepypastastories.com, where you can find links to many different piles of information, either on social media or one of his many short stories. If you do decide to stop by the profile, please leave Kyle a kind word and let him know that you heard about him here on this show and that Otis Gyre sent you. It would mean a lot to me and Kyle. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. But back to our tale. It seems Robert should have paid closer attention to Rossetti's motto. We won't rest until everyone is perfect. Wait, did I read that correctly? Maybe they should pay closer attention to those students they're churning out. Maybe we'd be better off hitting the road. In our second tale by Kyle Harrison, we go next to Malaysia, where the culture is vibrant, the food is fantastic, and a local fling leads to horrific consequences for several friends, one of whom still can't ignore his darker past. Without further ado, I present to you The Child Market. The Child Market by Kyle Harrison, performed by Otis Chiry. It started with a call from a friend, Luke. "Rob, you wake?" he asked in a panic as I groggily searched for my glasses. "I'm now," I remarked dryly as I checked the time. 3:30 in the morning. "This had better be good," he said as I sat up and listened to his ramble. "Yeah, I know. You can bite my head off later. Look, I'm in deep," he responded. His voice sounded frantic, like he had just killed someone. I soon learned that wasn't far off with my guess. "Do you remember Dia? Met her in Georgetown a few weeks back at the art festival. Anyway, we've been hooking up since then," and his voice trailed off. Even in a half-woke state of mind, I knew what he was implying. "You got her pregnant, didn't you?" I said, since it was too slow to spit it out. "I did, Rob. She did the test an hour ago." "Jesus, what do I do?" he asked. I sighed and rubbed my forehead tiredly. "How the hell should I know? What'd she say? Have you told anyone else yet?" "If the dean finds out, you'll be a dead man," I told him. No, she's asleep in the other room. But I'm freaking out here, dude. I can't have a kid now. We've been here nearly 2 years. I've done too much to go home now, and if I report it... Again, he didn't seem to have the strength to finish his words. You'll lose your scholarship and be on the next flight home so fast, your head'll spin. It's $50,000 down the drain, I remarked. That's why I called you. I figured you could talk to her, Luke responded. And say what? I gritted my teeth. I could already tell where this conversation was going. I don't know. You and Jenny worked things out last year when we were in Prague. Worked magic, man, he sputtered. I clenched the phone, wishing I could reach through it and strangle my friend. He didn't have a clue what he was talking about. But then no one really did. That was different, was the only response I felt he deserved. Come on, Rob. You know the language better than any of us. Man, I don't know who else to turn to. I felt sorry for him. Luke didn't come from money, so I knew that if he did lose this, it would be the end. We'd signed up as foreign exchange students together over 3 years back, choosing 4 different countries to study abroad in the field of astronomy and agricultural engineering. Our stay here in Malaysia had been extended only due to bad weather, so the dean had given us some time to recoup. For 2 guys thousands of miles away from any American girls, that meant clubbing and flirting with any Asian cutie who dared to look our way. I'd probably hooked up with 3 or 4 myself since we settled here on the island of Parang. But unlike Luke, I tried to be sensible, always wore protection, and rarely ever slept with a chick twice. Luke, on the other hand, always thought with his heart instead of his head, until it was too late. I used to be like that with Jenny, I thought as I turned over and stared toward the window toward the beach. The gentle rhythm of the waves reminded me of her. Our secret rendezvous always was at the Vltava River, sneaking into old churches to make out, and joking about bolts of lightning splitting the spires apart to render divine judgment. Dwelling on it brought back old wounds, so I jumped out of bed and took some sleeping pills. I would need to be on the top of my game if I hoped to help Luke and Dia at all, especially if I wanted to convince my friend not to repeat the same mistakes I did. Mornings in the island are something to witness. There's no such thing as laziness here. The entire city seems to come alive as soon as the sun is up. Sometimes even earlier. It's a short 10-block walk to where I know Luke is staying, but I first stop at the Charasta Market and grab myself some breakfast. Despite being rooted in Tamil culture, the place actually has a variety of foods, and if there's one thing the locals know, it's that we Americans like to eat. So I grab a bowl of Kyoto Ting, my personal favorite, and wash it down with a glass of Te Tarik. I sometimes flirt with the mixer that makes the beverage, but this particular morning, my mind is fixed on what I'm going to say to Luke and his girl. Somehow or other, my eyes fixate on a sculpture not far from my booth, 2 stony faces looking back at me. The pair are identical, save for a few key details. One is holding rocks and the other fruit, and the one hefting the rocks is unhappy. Which one are you? Voice asks, breaking me from my concentration. It's an older Malaysian woman dressed in a little more than rags. Her face was covered in warts and her smile crooked and contemptuous of me as a foreigner. But her question intrigues me. Excuse me? What do you mean? I reply back in her native tongue. This seems to surprise her, as many Americans don't bother to learn the dialect here. Parang has at least 7 major languages, but her garments told me she was likely born here and preferred Hokkien. Laborer or trader, the old woman said, gesturing toward the iron rod motif with a bony finger. Well, perhaps both, I told her, realizing that in my current circumstances that might be applicable. Impossible, One cannot be both. Either servant or master, she said back. I don't know why, but the way she spoke seemed harsh and critical, and it irritated me. What did she know about my life or the choices I make? I stood up and left the tip, nodding toward the crone and started down the street. It is better for you to decide now, my child, before the decision is made for you, she said in a thick English accent just as I was exiting the marketplace. I turned to look back, but she had immersed herself in the crowd. Then I looked back up at the stone caricature, one smiling, the other angry. Had their expression switched? Ignoring it, I whipped out my phone and texted Luke, telling him to meet me at his hotel lobby. Already, there was his response. Dia's up in the room. She's been scared and upset all night, he told me as I got inside. I would be too if you'd knock me up, I joked, but it didn't seem like the time for that, especially since I needed him to level with me. I'm going to go up and talk to her. I want you to stay here until I get back. No need to make this any worse than it needs to be, I told him. What are you going to say? Luke muttered. I'll tell her what she needs to do. He nodded, trying not to pass out from anxiety, as I rushed over to the elevator and pressed for the fourth floor. Somewhere I read that number is considered bad luck on the islands, but then I was never one to believe in superstition. There are far worse evils we cause ourselves, without any help from ghosts, I thought grimly as I rapped on the door. Dia answered it, wearing her nightgown but looking disheveled and tired. I'd only hung out with her a few times, but by the look on her face, something told me she'd guessed why I was there. Luke tell you? She asked in broken English, letting me into the room. Yeah, he did. How are you feeling? I muttered as I glanced about the small dorm that my friend was leasing. It looked like Dee had trashed the place a little during the initial shock. Never mind, I added as I sat down on the couch and watched her pace the room. Luke say you've been through before, she asked, gently rubbing her belly and muttering. Your father? I was, but what happened to me shouldn't really matter. This is you, your body. What are you thinking, dear? I whispered back. Tell me about baby. Then I tell you what I am thinking, she said, slowing down to carefully enunciate words. I sighed. I'd prepared myself to tell this story, but it was never easy. There's much to say. We didn't plan to have a child, and we both agreed we weren't ready, so it was agreed to terminate the pregnancy. I answered, giving her the shortest version possible. But of course she had questions. You mean you, what is the word? Go to Pasran Kanak? Dia asked. I didn't know the phrases she used, but the look of horror on her face told me she at least understood how my story had unfolded. Yes, it was mutual, but it ended our relationship. And it shouldn't affect your choice, I told her. The Malaysian woman became silent, thinking over what I had just said. I couldn't tell by her expression whether she was silently judging me or considering the option for herself. It was never an easy choice to make. Like I said, I want you to feel comfortable. Whatever you decide, I can convince Luke to be on board with it, I told her. I knew that my buddy was probably hoping it would be the opposite, that I would come up here and tell his girl to abort the baby. In fact, that was all but confirmed a moment later, when he did burst into the room, eager to find out what Dia had decided. The two looked at each other wordlessly, both of their expressions, a mixture of frustration, confusion, and anxiety. Not the type of faces anyone should wear when bringing a child into the world, I thought. They weren't ready, but then whoever was. I want to keep, Dia said finally. Luke looked aghast. No, you can't. Rob, tell her. Then he froze and flared at me accusingly. Wait, what the hell did you tell her? He had his hands on my shirt now, pulling me toward him. "Get your hands off me, man," I said, pushing him away. I told her exactly the truth about me and Jenny. Dia looked confused and frightened by our sudden, heated argument. "I asked for your help, not to stab me in the back," Luke said, running his fingers through his hair. "Look, Dia's a grown woman. It's time you start acting like a grown man," I shouted back. I turned to look at her, realizing she was on the verge of tears. "You don't want children?" Dia asked him. Her hurt tone seemed to soften Luke's indignation. "No, sweetie, no. It's not that at all." He went over to her and took her hands gently in his. I don't want kids now. I'm not even 30 yet. I don't have anything. What sort of father would I be?" Luke mumbled. Dia seemed confused by his English, so I quickly translated what I could and sighed. This was a mistake for me to come. "I'm sorry, Luke." He ignored me, gently playing with his girlfriend's hair near to her earlobe, and said, "Wait. Rob, I need you to translate something to her." I sighed again. "Sure. Tell her this scholarship is my whole future on the line. My everything, my only shot. Tell her that." I shortened the message, disgusted with myself that I was convincing her to even listen to Luke's selfishness. I hated being the middleman. Dia shed a few tears, then nodded weakly. "I will do it." I was stunned. Luke seemed thrilled. In her native tongue, she said something again about the Kennick Kennick, then said, "I know where we go." "When?" Luke asked, and I glared at him. "Hold up a minute, dear. Are you sure this is what you want?" "Of course she is. She just said she was." "Luke, shut it," I growled. Dia nodded and said simply, "No father, no family. No family, no love." I could feel the resignation in her words. It was faint, but it was there. I didn't have any rebuttal for her, so she went to the other room to get changed. Then I glared at my friend, disappointed with his devil-may-care attitude. Just then, Luke's smartphone buzzed to life and interrupted us. He went to grab it and frowned as he read whatever message he got. "What is it?" I asked. "From the dean to the whole class. We're leaving on the next flight for Singapore tomorrow. Maybe even tonight," he said, turning to me frantically. "I have to pack. I have to get my papers done for finals," Luke said. "What have you been doing the past few weeks?" I turned toward Dia, who was just returning, wearing casual wear, realizing the unfortunate remark I was making toward her. "I have to do this now or I'll flunk," Luke told us both. He was pushing responsibility toward me as usual. "Fine, I'll take Dia. You get my stuff and yours packed for tonight. Deal?" I snarled. He didn't even make a counteroffer. I huffed and told Dia what was happening as we left the room. I was afraid if I stayed any longer, I might smash Luke's smug face into the wall. I realized as we rode down the elevator to the streets of Georgetown that he wasn't really my friend after all. Our whole relationship seemed built on favors we did for one another. I resolved this one would be my last. Besides, I reasoned, I wasn't doing this for him anyway. I glanced toward Dia, realizing her entire body seemed to be shaking like a leaf as we moved through the streets toward the old square. "Hey, listen to me. You can still change your mind," I told her. She didn't bother responding. Instead, she moved toward the cramped streets, the poor settlements that stuck out in the lower quarter like a sore thumb. As we walked on, something about the area seemed to give an air of menace. It felt claustrophobic and dangerous, dark and sinister. And I knew that if I was experiencing this, there was no telling what Dia was going through. But still, she pressed onwards. Beggars and impoverished crowded us on all sides. dilapidated buildings blocking out the sun, and then at last she stopped in front of a four-story near the riverfront. On the side of the building in white paint was the Malaysian phrase she had used earlier, and below it in the equivalent English. Reading the translation made my throat very dry. Panic, panic. Child. Pazaran. Market. The child market. Dia viewed the act of abortion the same as selling her child, I realized. She stepped through one of the drab hanging curtains with me, not far behind. Nothing about the place even came close to being professional, or even sanitary. The walls were a bland and drab white, the stone floor covered in droppings and dust. A teenage girl, probably only 5 years younger than us. Dia didn't hesitate to grab the ledger and sign. Then we sat together in an uncomfortable silence as we waited for our turn. Had flashbacks to Prague, thinking of the clinic Jenny and I had gone to. It had been far nicer than this, but the cold aloofness of the staff felt the same. Maybe it was the universe's way of telling people that unless you were here for the right reasons, then something bad would happen. I wasn't quite sure what the right reasons to rob a child of their life might be, but I knew that it was the woman's right to decide whether or not a fetus was considered alive. I found a little comfort that Dia was not far along, so the chances of the baby feeling anything were slim. This was the way it should be, rather than a drawn-out process that would end in grief and bitter feelings. The teen receptionist told us to come back to one of the rooms, silently gesturing for Dia to sit on the exam table. "Thank you, being here," she told me. All I did was make an uncomfortable smile. But it faded away when the door opened, and a familiar old crone showed herself. It was the old hag from that morning. I could have recognized her a mile away. As she entered the room and set aside her cane, she cackled and gestured for me to stand aside. "So you came to make trade?" she asked Dia, although her eyes were on me. Luke's girl answered affirmatively, and she placed her ear on Dia's belly, listening. "I can hear a heartbeat. You are further along than you realized," the aged doctor declared. I felt my own heart drop with the news. "We should call the whole thing off," I told Dia. "There's no need to worry. Her child will be safe even after death," the crone said solemnly. I didn't know what she meant, but I squeezed Dia's hand, hoping she would see reason. I didn't want her to deal with the same thing that Jenny had. "I will be all right," she reassured me. That was the end of the discussion. The doctor made another short cackle and prepped for the surgery. "I won't leave you," I told her. I hadn't been there for Jenny. I'd been a coward at the last minute. But this time it felt necessary for me to stay. Something about all this was growing more and more tense by the second. "Such courage. You would have made a fine father," the crone said as she gathered her tools, the long mandibles and shears that she would use to pry out Dia's infant as though it were a cancerous tumor. But the way she said it was what disturbed me the most. Did she know of my previous experience? It didn't seem possible. But then many things about this felt wrong. "What did you mean when you said earlier you would protect the child, even after death?" "It is our way. Children have spirits within them even before birth. Those that cannot make it into our world must find other ways of surviving the cruel realities of life. All we do is help those lost souls find a new owner," she said simply as her Tex held Dia down and motioned for shackles to be placed on her arms and her legs to be put in stirrups. "Aren't you going to sedate her?" I asked nervously as the surgical team got ready. Dia's eyes were widening in confusion, and she started to mouth words I didn't understand. It is better for the waking to take place with both the laborer and the trader fully aware, the doctor told me, pressing her cold hands on my shoulders. They made me feel frozen in place as she finished tightening the straps. It sounds like some kind of black magic or something, I said, my hands feeling clammy. She smiled as my friend's pupils grew wider and darker, making another cackle. Precisely. The doctor raised her scalpel up to make the first incision, and I tried to move and stop her. Then I realized I couldn't. My body was paralyzed somehow. Had it been the old woman's touch? I think I must have screamed, but there was no one there to listen, just like it had been with Jenny when I left her. Now I was the one to witness the consequences of selfishness firsthand. They made the cut straight along the lower portion of Dia's belly. Now my scream joined hers. Her fists clenched in pain and shock as her water broke and slithered out of her womb. Another cut, tissue and bone cracking as they used the mandibles to break apart her body. Amid the sinew and blood, the old hag cackled. Her visage resembled that of a witch now, her skin withered and decayed. A living demon here, bringing forth another of its kind into our world. And I, the cooperative party that led the sheep to the slaughter. The mandibles pressed open, the long umbilical cord of the fetus cascading to the dirty floor below, to reveal the unformed infant. Its skin was as dry and rotted as the hag, its eyes not even there. Its mouth opened to reveal jagged teeth and a forked tongue, hissing and compliant as the team worked tirelessly to free it from its prenatal prison. The witch took off her gloves, placing her hands on the dark and malformed head of the creature, and gently pried it loose from Dia. All the while, my friend's screams infected my mind. My body, powerless to stop it, as they turned toward me, the unborn evil in their hands. The witch held the demon toward me as though making an offering, and then chanted a magic spell I didn't understand. The room around me grew black and cold. The infant was placed in my arms, but I had no will of my own. Suddenly I was somewhere else. I could see Jenny experiencing the same harsh surgery in Prague a year ago. Child that now had been given up was joining the ranks of the unholy as well. I remember crying. I couldn't help but grit my teeth at the disgusting truth of what I had done to the woman I loved. Why hadn't I insisted we keep the child? There'd been nothing to keep us from becoming a family except fear. The malicious creature that slowly intertwined its finger with mine, which I cradled, was the embodiment of that. The very epitome of all the wickedness that selfish men like me do to women around the world. Jenny had trusted me to make the choice the same way Dia had. Even Luke, in his naivete thinking, because I had once knocked the girl up, I knew anything at all about the sanctity of life. But I didn't. This dark and hollow monster was a reminder of that. The evil toil gnawed at me, ripping at bits of my skin, its body hardly there anymore, still clinging to the spirit world. It was crawling inside my body, infecting me with its hellish madness. I tried to fight it, tried to call out to Jenny or Dia, or even the witch that had cursed me with these secrets. But instead, all I found was I was holding nothing but soot and dried blood in a matter of seconds. Creature, the proof of this curse, was now inside me forever. As the room reverted to normal, I saw Dia was dead on the table, the shock and exhaustion of the inhuman procedure proving too much for her to handle. Then the witch smiled down at my contorted face as she knew all too well what pain I was experiencing. "You know now what you must do," she said. I stood up, my hand shaking. I did know. I stumbled through the streets of Georgetown, looking likely like a madman, covered in blood and other grime. Many of the locals gave me a wide berth. It was Luke that found me, somehow it made it back to the square where I first met the old witch hag that morning. Not for sure how long I'd been there, staring up at the sculpture, but his amazement at my appearance told me it had not been a dream. Deer was gone. The ritual the witch had performed was real. I now had a job to do. "Rob, talk to me. We have to go. The plane's about to board," he said, snapping me back to reality as he hailed a cab. "I'm not going to Singapore," I told him. For once in his life, he didn't question it. He was too concerned for my sanity, I guess. But I didn't care about all that. All that mattered was going home. When I got to the terminal, I told the dean everything. All the lies, the secrets that Jenny and I had hidden for over a year. "I know," was all that he told me. "The burden you've been doing for so long, I think I can see it passing on to someone else now." He was gesturing toward Luke. Was he right? Would my friend ever actually learn the responsibility of something like this? I wasn't sure. I only cared about making it to Jenny. The flight home was long. The dark oceans reminded me of the surgery. When I closed my eyes, all I saw was the hell beast I knew raged inside me now. But finally, I made it. And gentle rain crashed down on JFK as I gathered my bags. Jenny was there waiting for me, the university having told her I was resigning from the program. "What have you done, Rob? What have you done?" she asked as she held me. The demon grew stronger inside, desperate to be set free. My mission was nearly over. "Please, please, can you ever forgive me?" I asked her. She touched my cheek and kissed it. "I'm here, aren't I?" she responded. From behind her, I heard a laugh. A little girl I'd never seen, except maybe in my dreams, splashed through the puddles and ran up to me, slinging her arms around my shoulders. "Daddy, is it really you? Are you back?" she asked as she kissed my neck. In my mind's eye, I saw myself walk out on Jenny 2 years ago when she had changed her mind. When I refused to be a man, to be a father, and made her go at it alone. I saw Luke facing a harsher reality when he knew that he was alone because of his selfishness. The demon that had infected me paling in comparison to the destruction of such decisions. And then I smiled and ran my fingers through my daughter's hair, the creature that had been sold to me out of guilt, quieting down inside my mind. If I became the laborer I was meant to be, I could find joy again. It felt like the trade I was supposed to make. "Yeah, Pumpkin, I'm back." I hope you enjoyed The Child Market by author Kyle Harrison, as performed by yours truly. If you've enjoyed the tales you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured author can be found by visiting our website. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Harrison, spelled H-A-R-R-I-S-O-N. With over 600 stories available for you to read through, there's surely something for everybody out there from Mr. Harrison, if you're brave enough to look. As a reminder, if you decide to give any of his talented stories a read, please consider leaving them a quality review and a kind word, or a thoughtful public comment and an upvote, and be sure to let them know you heard about them on this program, and that Otis Gyre sent you. It means more to me than you can imagine, and I'm sure Kyle would appreciate it very much as well. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's featured author. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky. Get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode, and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well, to get more spooky tales from me and the crew, and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now All you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.